Abner coughed and explained, "It has always been the job of the church to correct the wrongs in any society, Pupali. If you give the money to a worthy cause, its kapu will be washed away." "On the other hand," Pupali argued, "your fine church has already been destroyed twice because the spirits of the land were angry at the way you built it." "It was a fire and a wind," Abner corrected. "And now, if you make even your own god angry at the church, it would surely burn down again," Pupali reasoned triumphantly. "So I cannot let you run this risk, Makuahale. I will keep the money." In fact, things had worked out so well for the shiftless man through the sale of Iliki that he now started introducing his three other daughters to as many whaling captains as possible. But they had grown fat and careless and found no takers. In spite of many such defeats, these were good years for Abner and Jerusha. They now had four children, two boys and two girls, each apparently gifted with superior intelligence. Abner was disappointed that the young ones could not play with the Janders and Whipple children, but since both Mrs. Janders and Amanda stubbornly allowed their offspring not only to associate with Hawaiians, but actually speak that lascivious language, the Hale youngsters were kept rigidly alone within their walled garden. They appeared at church each Sunday, handsomely scrubbed, and often at twilight Abner would lead them to the waterfront, where they would study the marvelous islands that rimmed Lahaina Roads, and the clever children would play the game of Spot the Whales, in which, at proper seasons of the year, they would try to detect mother whales and their babies. The family came to enjoy these end-of-day respites as the finest part of the week, and much of the poetry of speech that marked the children derived from these hours when they watched the sunsets and the islands. In December, the sun set almost over the middle of Lanai, as if it were a fireball going back to sleep in the dead volcano of that gracious island. But in June, the great fiery sun sank off the coast of Molokai, rushing with crimson and orange streamers into the blue ocean. Then, with daylight fading, the children would listen for the talking owls and the gentle motion of the rising wind in the coconut palms. What they loved best, however, was when their father pointed toward the rotting hulk of the Thetis and said, "I remember when your dear mother and I sailed from Boston in that brig." And he convinced the children that they belonged to three precious fraternities. "You are the children of God. All men are your brothers. And you are descended from the bravest group that ever came to Hawaii, the missionaries that sailed aboard the Thetis." One night, Micah whispered to his mother, "Father tells us that all men are brothers, but the ones who sailed on the Thetis are a little better than the others, aren't they?" And to the boy's surprise, his mother said, "Your father is correct. The world holds no finer people than those who sailed aboard the Thetis." But Micah noticed that year by year in his father's stories of that fateful voyage, the waves got higher and the space in the little stateroom more cramped. Jerusha found abiding joy in these days, for her 9 years in Lahaina had taught her how to master life within a grass house. Her two great enemies were bedbugs and cockroaches, but scrupulous cleanliness controlled the first, and meticulous care in wrapping every edible crumb in time dismayed the roaches so that they marched away to some more careless house. Even so, the grassy walls, lined though they were with smooth and fragrant pandanus matting, were convenient hiding places for all kinds of insects, and often at night one would roll over on his pallet and hear the squashing sound of some hard-shelled vermin being crushed. Nor could the dust from the pebbled floor ever be adequately controlled. But life was possible, and at times even palatable. There was some talk between Amanda Whipple and Luella Janders that their patient sister Jerusha was killing herself in the damp grass shack, and together they sent a petition to the mission board in Honolulu, begging for some lumber. Our husbands have volunteered to build a decent house for this Christian and long-suffering woman, if you will but supply the timbers, they wrote. But since one of the signatories was Amanda Whipple, who was known to have encouraged her husband when he abandoned the mission, and since Whipple had twice been additionally censured for marrying American sailors to Hawaiian girls, the petition came to naught, and Jerusha continued to live and work inside the dark, damp grass shack. Abner, had he known of Amanda's move, would have been outraged, for he stubbornly maintained his original conviction. We have been sent here as the servants of God. Through gifts to the mission, he will provide for us as he deems best. It was, however, trying to Jerusha to see her four children clothed only in such remnants as the mission board could send her from the charity barrels. And she tried her health still further by constantly ripping apart gift clothing, smoothing out the larger pieces of cloth thus provided, and sewing them into new garments for her children. On one point, however, she was adamant. We have got to have books for Micah. If you don't write to the board demanding them, I shall have to. She was not above stopping whaling captains on the streets and begging them for any books which they might have done with and which her brilliant son could read. I am trying to teach him all he requires for entrance into Yale, she explained. But he reads so fast and understands so well. In one way or another, she got the books. Each year, Jerusha had had one moment of complete motherly happiness. It coincided with the arrival of the annual gift box from her parents in Walpole, New Hampshire. Each November, they dispatched it. But she could never be certain when a ship's captain would knock on her Dutch door saying, "We've a box for you, ma'am." How exciting it was to get that message. But how infinitely more exciting to see her family standing in a circle as Abner ripped away the top. There were dried apples, and spiced pears, and hard dried beef. These pants will be for Micah, Jerusha would say carefully, lingering over each item. And this dress will fit Lucy. David can have this, and Esther this. On the succeeding Sunday, at least, Jerusha could look back over her shoulder as her children marched to church in their new clothes, and she could be proud of them. She always allowed the box to stay in the house long after it was empty, and whenever she looked at it, she could recall the cold winters of New Hampshire and the smell of cider. A major reason why Abner would have found it impossible to accept aid from the Whipples was this. A phrase of John's kept running through his mind and seemed to him to summarize the apostasy into which his former roommate had fallen. At strange times, Abner would hear ringing in his ears John's sharp pronouncement, "I don't think the Ali'i sent the wind, and I don't think God sank the ships." The more he reflected on this, the more contemptible it sounded. In simple terms, Abner rationalized, what he has done is to equate heathen idols of the Ali'i with God himself. How appalling! And increasingly, he kept away from John Whipple, for, without either man's being aware of the fact, as Whipple's financial fortunes grew, so did Abner Hale's deepening reliance upon the Lord. And since in Lahaina, as elsewhere, these lines of development are not parallel but are actually divergent, so that the distance between them increases, the two men grew not to comprehend each other. Nevertheless, Whipple remained interested in Abner's welfare. And it was with both amazement and relief that he heard one day from a Salem captain, lately sailing from Boston, that a preposterous yet tantalizing thing was occurring on the wharves of that city. Matter of fact, it's no doubt completed by now, the incredulous captain explained. There was this man named Charles Bromley, out of New Hampshire, and he was building a complete two-storied wooden house right on the dock, within spitting distance of the bay. No cellar, but everything complete, even to window cords. As soon as it was done, carpenters went over the entire thing with paintbrushes and numbered every piece of wood in the house. Draftsmen drew pictures of everything and indicated the numbers. Then what do you suppose happened? The captain asked dramatically. damned if they didn't start knocking the whole house down and carrying it aboard this ship, plank by plank. "What ship?" Whipple asked. "Carthaginian, Captain Hawksworth out of Bedford," the captain said. "I would deeply appreciate it, Captain, if you would keep this matter a secret," Whipple said. "As a matter of fact," the man said, "the house is headed for these islands, Honolulu probably. I was so fascinated I spoke to this fellow Bromley. He didn't want to talk, but he did say that the idea was Captain Hawksworth's. The captain came to him and said that this mission family in Honolulu, living like swine, you know, grass house, bedbugs, cockroaches. Why Bromley was building the house, I didn't get clear." "Will you promise me?" Whipple pleaded. "Of course," the captain agreed. "I assure you, Captain," Whipple said, "you will be protecting a wonderful woman from hurt if you will keep your mouth shut about this. And I shall, too." Dr. Whipple's preoccupation with anything so minor as a new house was superseded when Abner became aware of mysterious events occurring in Lahaina without his being able to identify them. And, since he considered himself arbiter of all that happened in the community, he was irritated to think that Hawaiians would wish to conduct important affairs behind his back. To the meeting in Honolulu, he reported, "I first became aware of this unusual secretiveness 4 days ago, when returning from inspection of a home that burned because the owner smoked tobacco. And after having admonished him for his sin, I happened to peer into Malama's old palace grounds, where I spotted several kahunas I knew, and they were supervising the building of a large new house. 'What are you building there?' I called. 'A small house,' they replied evasively. 'What for?' I inquired. 'The other houses have grown musty,' they lied. 'What other houses?' I prodded. 'Those over there,' they said, waving their arms in some vague direction. 'Exactly which ones?' I insisted. This question they did not answer, so I pushed my way into the compound and inspected the new house, finding it spacious, with real doors, windows, and 2 Chinese mirrors. 'This is a very substantial house,' I said to the kahunas, but they shrugged me off by saying, 'It's a pretty small house.' So I left the deceiving rogues and went in turn to each of the other houses and smelled them, and not one was musty. So I challenged the kahunas and asked, 'Tell me what you are building.' And they replied, 'A house.' And I left the conspirators, convinced that something suspicious is afoot, but what it is, I do not know." Abner was pondering these exasperating mysteries when he saw from his Dutch door a line of 7 natives coming down from the hills, bearing mile branches and great bouquets of ginger flowers. Leaving his Bible translating, he hurried to the roadway and demanded, "Why are you bearing mile and ginger?" "We don't know," the Hawaiians replied. "Who sent you to the hills?" Abner insisted. "We don't know." "Where are you taking the flowers?" "We don't know." "Of course you know," he fumed. "It's ridiculous to say you don't know where you're going." And he limped after them to the waterfront, where they wandered off, each in his own accidental direction. Infuriated, Abner stood for some minutes in the hot sun, trying to piece together his various clues. Then, jamming his hands into his coat pockets, he stomped over to J&W's and said brusquely, "John, what's going on in Lahaina?" "What do you mean?" Whipple parried. "I just encountered 7 natives bringing down mile and ginger. Why are they doing that?" "Why didn't you ask them?" "I did, and they'd tell me nothing." "Probably some kind of ceremony," Whipple guessed. Abner both despised and feared this word, for it conjured up forbidding rites and heathen sex orgies. So he asked tentatively, "You mean pagan ceremonies?" Then Whipple remembered. "Now that you bring it up, 2 days ago some of the whalers wanted extra supplies of tapa for caulking. Usually I can find 100 yards by snapping my fingers, but I went to 12 homes and they were all making tappa, but no one had any for sale. "What were they doing with it?" Abner pressed. "They all said the same thing. It's for Kelolo." At this, Abner placed before the doctor the various bits of evidence he had collected, and when they had studied the facts, he asked, "John, what's going on?" "I don't know," Whipple replied. "Have Kelolo and his children been in church recently?" "Yes, as pious as they ever were." "I'd keep my eye on Kelolo," Whipple laughed. "He's a wily old shark." And for the rest of that day, Abner brooded over the fact that an event of obvious significance had been masked from his surveillance. But his present exasperation was nothing compared to what it became when, in the late afternoon, he heard, as if from a distant valley, the muffled, haunting throb of a pagan drum. He listened, and it stopped. Then it began again, and he cried, "The hula!" Without even informing Jerusha of where he was going, he started out in search of the long-forbidden hula, and he followed the echoes from one area to the next, until at last he pinpointed them as coming from a house on the edge of town. Hurrying along a winding footpath, he was determined to catch the lascivious revelers and punish them, when suddenly, from behind a tree, a tall native casually stepped into the middle of the path, asking, "Where are you going, Makuahale?" "There's a hula in that house," Abner said ominously. But the man must have been a sentry, for when Abner reached the place from which the drum had echoed, he found only a collection of sweet-faced men and women practicing hymns, with never a drum in evidence. "Where did you hide them?" he stormed. "Hide what, Makuahale?" "The drums." "We had no drums, Makuahale," they said with the most winning simplicity. "We were singing hymns for Sabbath." But when he reached home again, he heard once more the sound of drums, and he told Jerusha, "Something is happening in this town, and it drives me mad that I can't find out what it is." He ate no supper, but later, as the moon was rising, he announced sternly, "I shall not go to bed till I discover what evil is afoot." Against Jerusha's protest, he donned his white shirt, best stock, clawhammer coat, and beaver hat. Then, fortifying himself with a stout cane, he went out into the warm tropical night, and for the first several minutes stood silent under the stars and the sighing palms, trying desperately to detect what was occurring in his parish. But he heard nothing. He wondered if Murphy had revived the hula in his grog shop, but when he crept past the saloon, it was orderly. He then went to the pier, suspecting that whalers might have conspired with Kelolo in organizing a debauch. But the ships were silent in the ghostly moonlight. And then, as he stood at the far end of the pier staring at the ships, he happened to see out of the corner of his eye a flickering light along the shore some distance to the south. He dismissed it with the thought, "A night fisherman with his torch on the reef." But it did not move as a fisherman should, and he muttered, "That's not one torch, it's several." And with this, he remembered the new grass house at Malama's, and he recalled the kahunas, and like a fish drawn to the torches, he limped off the pier and started walking along the edge of the coral reef, past the fort, past the great Ali'i homes, and out toward Malama's. And as he walked silently through the sand, the torches grew brighter, and it became obvious that a considerable celebration was in progress, one at which he was not welcome. He therefore moved stealthily, slipping from one coconut palm to the next, until at last he came upon a hidden spot from which he could spy upon the palace grounds. And the first thing he saw was a concentration of guards at the gate that led from the public road into the compound, and he thought with satisfaction, "Those guards are there to keep me out. What evil are my people up to?" He had not long to wait, for from a crowd of men who had been feasting on roast pig, Kelolo stepped forth in brilliant yellow robes, accompanied by six kahunas in feathered capes. Kilolo dropped his hand. And from an area near the beach, a night drum began to sound, and then another, and finally a high-pitched variant which established a throbbing, disciplined rhythm. Suddenly, from the crowd, six women whom Abner had seen in the house singing hymns moved forth, naked to the waist, and with red flowers in their hair, necklaces of polished black nuts about their shoulders, and anklets of shark's teeth which clicked as they began an ancient hula. Abner, who had often railed against this dance, had never seen it. And now, as the swaying skirts made of tea leaves moved in the faltering shadows, he noticed how solemn and graceful the dance was. For the women seemed to be disembodied spirits, undulating in response to night winds. A movement would start in their heads, work its way along their supple arms, and pass to their hips in one unbroken symphony of motion. "This isn't what I expected," Abner muttered. "I understood that naked men and women..." But his fleeting concession was interrupted by what now took place, for he stood appalled as a chanter leaped before the dancers and began to cry mournfully, yet in exultation, "Great Kani, guardian of the heavens! Great Kani, guardian of the night! King of the gods, ruler of all men! Kani, 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 attend our ceremony, bless our shore." And as Abner stared in disbelief, from the new grass house Kilolo appeared, bearing in his reverent hands the ancient stone of Kani. It should have been long since destroyed, but it had survived through Kilolo's love, and now he placed it upon the low stone altar near the shore. When it was in position, he shouted, "Great Kani, your people welcome you home." Over the crowd, a deep silence settled as each Hawaiian filed past Kilolo to deck the altar with flowers. And when this was done, the kahunas chanted. Then, at a signal from Kilolo, the drums hammered out a new and wilder rhythm. The hula dancers swayed more joyously, and the people of Lahaina welcomed back their ancient god. In spite of Abner's hundreds